So I've got a friend who started as a curate, an assistant minister at a church in the East End of London a while ago. And when he started, the church owned a house and they did it up for him. Except they did that whole thing of going to B&Q and buying sort of bits for the house that looked really expensive but were really cheap. So of course everyone in the church sort of started coming to the house saying, oh, look at you, you got the nice house. And it was kind of, yeah, taps that looked like they were chrome but actually plastic. And so you get 2 months down the line and he's turning taps and they're breaking in his hand and all the rest of it. Well, what we see in this passage is people who seem to have a pretty shiny faith, but actually very quickly it begins to fall apart. So last week we looked at the early part of the passage. We saw that Jesus is the light of the world. He's come to rescue. And if you look at verse 30, just before we kicked in, John says, as he was saying these things, many believed in him. So then verse 31, Jesus said to the Jews who had believed in him, if you abide in my word, you're truly my disciples. So he's speaking to people who, on the face of it, have believed in Jesus. And yet what we see as the passage goes through is the tone of it gets increasingly confrontational. And Jesus actually ends up saying that these people who appear to believe are the slaves to sin and they're not children of God. In fact, they're children of the devil. And I guess it's one thing when a bathroom falls apart, but it's another thing when someone's Christian faith begins to fall apart. So we might read about it sometimes in the newspapers, some high-profile scandal, and you know, the tabloids love it. But there's always a question, I think, in my mind of, well, there must have been faith there at some point. How did that person get from there to there? Maybe we're conscious of it in our own lives, perhaps Christian friends of ours, perhaps a high-profile pastor. They seem to have a really strong faith, and then they drift away. And it just makes us wonder why. And maybe it makes us slightly concerned. Well, what about my faith? What about the faith of my friends? How do I know that I can keep going with Jesus? And if we're looking into the Christian faith, often people who are looking into the faith say to me, well, I don't want to start this and not keep going. I think it's quite a good question, actually. How would we know this wouldn't just be a fad? How would we know we wouldn't end up wanting it to be a fad and just look back and be slightly embarrassed? How can someone fall so far, whether from faith or from some other kind of purpose that they set for themselves? And so Jesus' answer in verse 31 seems to be that if you abide in my word, you're truly my disciples. In other words, disciples are not just those who profess faith, but those who hold on to Jesus' teaching. So to keep going in the Christian life, we need to be centered on Jesus, and there are plenty of distractions. So I want to suggest from this passage three things to remember if we want to hold on to Jesus. And I think they'll be helpful if we're Christian. I think they'll be helpful if we're looking into the Christian faith to get a sense of what's at the heart of it. And they're on the handout there. And the first is we need to remember that there's no freedom without Jesus. So verse 31, Jesus told the Jews who believed him, if you abide in my word, you're truly my disciples, and you'll know the truth, and the truth will set you free. I guess if there's one thing that will shift us from our convictions, it's the sense that moving somewhere else will make us free. And Jesus is saying that there's no freedom without me. I remember once going to a zoo in the Cotswolds, Country Life Park or something was, and there was a tiger in a cage there, and it was sort of pacing up and down. And in front of the cage, there was this big expanse of parkland up to the country house. And every now and then, it would just stop and gaze longingly across the parkland, just longing to do what it's made to do, which is to run across the park. And there it was. Freedom is something that we long for. And that is what Jesus promises here. You'll know the truth, and the truth will set you free. The truth there, I think, is essentially the truth about Jesus. It's believing the gospel. The question then becomes, what kind of truth are we talking about? Because they hear him speaking physically. So verse 33, we're offspring of Abraham and have never been enslaved to anyone. How is it that you say you will become free? Which is a slightly extraordinary thing to say, because for the Jewish people to say we've never been slaves of anyone, and as far as I can think, Jewish people have been slaves to Egypt, to Assyria, to Babylon, to Greece, to Syria, and then at that point in history there were slaves to Rome. So Jesus is there in the temple, and the Roman soldiers would never go into the temple, but it's every chance that this crowd, as soon as they step out of the temple, the first thing they'll see is a Roman garrison going past with the stamping of feet and the blaring of trumpets and all the rest of it. So it's an extraordinary kind of complacency, a denial that they need freedom. We've never been slaves to anyone. So Jesus clarifies what he's talking about in verse 34. He says, truly, truly, I say to you, everyone who commits sin is a slave to sin. In other words, the slavery he's talking about is slavery to sin, that sort of instinct within all of us that means that naturally we disobey God, we do what's wrong, we instinctively live for ourselves and not how God would have us live, which means that by definition there's distance between us and God. God is angry with us, we face his justice for not living as he would have us live. And the freedom that he's talking about is freedom from that. Freedom from being opposed to God, freedom from his justice, freedom from that sort of instinct to disobey him. Or to put it more positively, freedom to live as God intended us to live. Think about the tiger in the cage. It's made to run. Well, how are we made to live? We're made to live as God meant us to live. And so the freedom he's talking about here is spiritual freedom. No freedom without Christ. And as such, I think this is quite a big contrast to the way that the world sees freedom. So do you remember when the atheists hired those bus slogans, what is it, 10 years ago or so? What was the slogan? There's probably no God, so stop worrying and enjoy your life. And I think the sort of assumption behind that is that worrying about what God thinks is very constraining. It's slavery. But freedom is found in just living for myself however I want. And I think Christians often get sucked into that. So we start looking over our shoulder at how people who don't believe in God live. And think, it's okay for them. They don't have a care in the world. And I think that is often that slippery slope to letting go of Jesus' words. But we have to ask, well, where does this freedom from God lead? And are we really free? So you look at an alcoholic turning into a bar at 11 o'clock in the morning. Are they free? Well, they might well say no. Where does it lead? Well, it leads to hurt and regret. And so it is with slavery to sin. There's no real freedom. And so often it leads to regret and shame. And I think with it comes this sense of, I think slavery is a really helpful picture of sin, because actually, you know, we'll leave church on a Sunday and we're determined that this week we're gonna do it right. And of course we don't. And I mean, it might be a sort of very obvious type of slavery, like an addiction, whether that is to alcohol or to pornography, or even to something like the praise of people. You know, I just need to constantly get approval, and if I don't get it, it makes me angry. It might be that kind of slavery. It might be the slavery that just gets angry at home. It might be the slavery that's just so used to massaging the truth in the office that, you know, it used to bother me, and now I just do it. It happens at the individual level. I think it happens as a society as well. What, we're nearly 9 billion people living in London. If every one of us is determined that we're free and we're going to live however we choose, it's not going to work out that well. So Jesus here is saying there's no freedom without him. And I think as he does so, he really unmasks this thing that might lead us away from Jesus, which is to seek this false freedom somewhere else. The answer then, he puts, is that he can set us free. So verse 35, the son does not remain in the house forever. The slave does not remain in the house forever. The son remains forever. So if the son sets you free, you'll be free indeed. I think the logic here is something like this. You know, we'll all have appraisals at work. And when we're at school, we all got a report card that we took home. Now, if you get a bad report card, take it home. You're not going to get kicked out of the house, hopefully. If you get a bad appraisal, well, actually, you might get kicked out of your job. The son has a kind of security, a permanence in the home, which a slave doesn't. So Jesus is the son. He belongs in heaven. And what he's saying is that because of that, he is the one who can therefore give us that freedom. So when Jesus died on the cross, he paid the penalty for all of our sin that we might be completely forgiven. And positively, he gives us his sonship, which means that I can now approach God not with fear, not with trying to prove that I'm good enough, not with fear of being expelled from his presence, but actually as his son, as a child, able to live as he intended and to belong. So Jesus is saying, look, I'm the one who can set you free because I'm the one who has that freedom with the Father. But they don't want to know. So verse 37, I know your offspring Abraham, but you seek to kill me because my words find their place in you. So it's their attitude to Jesus. They want to kill him that actually belies their slavery. And so I guess the questions that we're left with are questions around whether we value the freedom that Jesus offers, whether we'll seek it. whether we'll admit that our pursuing the freedom, so-called freedom of sin, is actually no freedom at all, or whether we'll envy people who just don't really care about God, whether we'll insist on standing on our rights to do as we please, regardless of where it leads. And more than that, whether we'll look to Jesus to set us free, or insist that we can free ourselves with our discipline, with our efforts, with just trying particularly hard this week and try and set myself free. And that seems to be the instinctive defense that the people that Jesus is speaking to go to. Their kind of basically answer is, well, I'm religious, so yes, sin's a bad thing, but I'll set myself free, thank you very much. You get a sense of that in verse 39. And this is the second thing I think we've got to remember, is there's no fatherhood of God without Jesus. So verse 39, they protest their defense. They say, but Abraham is our father. In other words, we're good, upright Jews. We're good religious people. We've got an impeccable religious pedigree, family, and culture. It'd be a bit like, I don't know, a soldier sort of tapping their breast and showing their badge of honor for their battalion. Look, I'm a Royal Green Jacket or a Welsh Guard or whatever it is. This is the badge that I wear. And you couldn't get much better pedigree than being a child of Abraham, as far as they're concerned. And I think many of us will do the same. We may not realize it, but actually we'll retreat into sort of relying on our upbringing, our background, something like that. They're saying that Abraham is their father. Ultimately, they're saying that God is their father. So verse 41, they sort of come back to this idea. They said to him, we're not born of sexual immorality. I think that's having a dig at the circumstances of Jesus' birth. We have one father, even God. So in their thinking, to be descended from Abraham was basically to be a child of God. Abraham, the first Jew, God picks him out of nowhere, makes promises to him, including that he will make him into a great nation. They say, well, we're that nation. We're the people of God. But Jesus puts it back and he says, actually, you're not children of God without me. And the word father appears 9 times in this section, so I think it's quite an important theme. And I guess in a good, I mean, I know people have bad experiences of fatherhood, but in a good father-child relationship, there should be deep security. A child should always approach their father knowing that they'll be accepted, that they'll be protected, they can approach with confidence. And that's how they view themselves with regard to God. We're God's children, we can always enter his presence because of our birth. But now Jesus begins to test it. So he says to them, verse 39, if you're Abraham's children, you'd be doing the works that Abraham did. But now you seek to kill me, a man who's told you the truth I heard from God. That's not what Abraham did. You're not acting the part. You're trying to kill me. That's not an Abraham-like attitude. So I got a couple of friends who play in the army bands. You know, they do the changing guard and stuff like that. And a few years ago, like back in the day, they were basically just professional musicians. They didn't do any fitness training. They hadn't seen any service. And then and a couple of them were getting a bit corpulent. So they decided they had to put them on a military fitness training regime. It's very controversial because they were kind of wearing the uniform of a soldier, but they didn't look like it. They'd never seen service. And that's really what Jesus says to these guys. You know, you're wearing the badge of God's people, but you're not actually acting the part. Abraham didn't try to kill God. He listened to the truth about God. And that is really Jesus' challenge to them. You can see it again in verse 42. If God were your father, you would love me, for I came from God and I'm here. I'm not here of my own accord. He sent me. In other words, if we want the fatherhood of God, then we need to love Jesus. And I guess, again, there's a sense in which many of us have that complacency before God based on our heritage. So it might be a Christian home that we brought up in. It might be that we feel that we've gone to the right type of church, or you know, something in our upbringing that makes us assume that God's on our side. I think often there can be something in us that's this thing. It might be upbringing. It might be where we are now. It might be, this is my upbringing, but now I'm, you know, I go to the right church. I go to St. James or St. Stephen's or whatever it is, and now I'm in there.
Yes.
I'm on the right side of this line. Yeah. And I was thinking about it earlier, I think a helpful question would be, if someone questioned me and said, well, you're not a real Christian, if I'm beginning to trust on my background, I'll get angry. And I'll start to point to my heritage rather than point to Jesus. So I'll say something like, have you any idea who I am? Have you any idea where I am on a Sunday? Or who brought me up or whatever it is? Rather than, well, yeah, of course I'm a sinner. Have you any idea what Jesus has done for me? But I think it's very easy. And again, if we're thinking about how we hold on to Jesus and keep going in the belief that will last, as soon as I'm relying on my heritage or my activity or my institutions, then I've just moved that one step away from him. And there's just a chance that I'm going to begin to rely on that. And then if that institution crumbles, there's a scandal or something like that, well, then everything crumbles with it, rather than me holding on to Jesus. Actually, I think sometimes what you see in this culture is people are quite anti-institutional, aren't they? And it might be people that actually say, oh, I've given up all of that. I've given up that institutional religion, and now I'm just doing it in my own way and feel slightly superior about it. But actually, not really want to know the truth. So spirituality is this sense of reaching out into the unknown. And then Jesus comes along and says, well, let me tell you about the unknown. And we almost don't want to know because we like that sort of sense of vagueness. And I think, again, we see that with the people here. They don't actually want to hear the truth. So if we said there's no freedom without Jesus, no fatherhood of God without Jesus, I think thirdly we see here, there's no truth apart from Jesus. And I guess we all like to think of ourselves as being open-minded and reasonable and people who weigh the truth. But actually, at heart, often we're quite close. And in verse 43, I think that's where Jesus begins to challenge them again. So he says, why do you not understand what I say? It's because you can't bear to hear my word. So they think they're open-minded, but they can't bear Jesus' word. And so he's saying, you're not actually interested in truth at all. And the reason, he says, is that they're children of the devil. Now, I think this is pretty strong. And I think we find this quite hard from the lips of Jesus. But it clearly matters to him. So let's go with it. He's saying the devil is real. And if we find that hard to believe, I think it's often because we have a caricature of the devil as kind of medieval paintings. Here he defines the devil as the father of lies. And it's therefore their lack of interest in the truth that shows that they're not really interested in Jesus. So verse 44, you are of your father the devil. Your will is to do your father's desires. He was a murderer from the beginning. It has nothing to do with the truth because there's no truth in him. When he lies, he speaks out of his character, which is a liar and the father of lies. So if you go to Bath, you know, the city where they've got the Roman baths, and you drink some of the spring water, it tastes quite eggy because the source of the spring has various sort of chemicals in it, sulfites, that make it taste that way. And all the water that comes out of the spring is tasted with this taste, tainted with the taste of those minerals. Well, so it is with the devil. Everything that comes from him is tainted with the taste of deceit. And that's why sin is actually slavery. Sin promises lies, doesn't it? It promises freedom, and yet actually it's no freedom at all. And so Jesus says, look, you can't accept the truth because you're children of the devil, because you are born to follow untruth. That's why you can't hear what I'm saying to you. In other words, the hallmark of being God's people is to love the truth and to hold on to Jesus, to keep going with him, is therefore to long for the truth and to have that self-awareness that actually as humanity we're constantly spinning towards deceit. That actually the devil is real, the world will throw all sorts of lies at us and half-truths, and we're naive if we're not awake to that, praying to God to show me truth and keeping me open-minded to Jesus. So that's three thoughts from the passage. No freedom without Jesus, no fatherhood of God without Jesus, no truth without Jesus. And I think overall what you see here on the one hand is a great hope, freedom, fatherhood, truth. On the other hand, quite a stark warning. Are we open-minded to this? Are we seeing our sin? Are we sticking with Jesus? And of course the two are related. Because as soon as I stop seeing Jesus as being true freedom and truth and fatherhood, then I'll begin to drift away from him, and that's when I'll be open to all sorts of lies of the devil.